to as FIP for short, and members are called FIPPers. We try to make it as fun as possible for this serious topic. FIP was started over 20 years ago by a woman named Donna Metcalf, and for 18 years she pretty much single-handedly had support group meetings and helped people, thousands of people, traverse through the prison system from arrest through reentry. And unfortunately, she got ill and passed away a couple years ago. So my job right now is to reconstitute the organization. And we're following in what Donna started as far as providing support to people. And we're calling them FIP circles. So this is where people can come together and learn from each other, people that have been through what they've been through, and be in a nice, comfortable, safe, loving place. Because, you know, when somebody is taken into the prison system, it's not something that somebody goes out and says, oh, my son was taken away, or my husband, or, you know, it's very personal and people don't know who to talk to. So the FIP circles are very important for people to come together and to learn from each other and have a safe place. And we also have a monthly speaker meeting where we have people from the community come and speak. We've had one of our assemblymen come, who is in charge of the chair of the judiciary, chairman of the judiciary committee. We've had people from Department of Corrections. We have somebody come from the police department coming. NAMI, the National Alliance of Mental Illness. Yeah. So what we're doing is raising awareness through our speaker meetings, where people can come and listen to others. So we have people affected by incarceration. The community at large is invited. Students are invited. We have people from law enforcement coming. And basically, with those two events a month, we're raising awareness and helping people, along with some other events that we're doing that we could talk about as we continue.
How did you come to be interested in this kind of work?
My brother was incarcerated a week ago, so FIP was one of the groups that I went to from time to time, and never really got too involved, but I knew it was a place that I could go where I could talk to people and feel safe, and they could answer my questions, and I didn't feel so alone. So I went to those meetings on and off for about 15 years until my brother passed away. He passed away in prison. And I stayed in touch with the group but didn't really do a whole lot until I decided to really move forward and make a difference and help people.
My condolences.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing
away, or my husband, or, you know, it's very personal and people don't know who to talk to. So the FIP circles are very important for people to come together and to learn from each other and have a safe place. And we also have a monthly speaker meeting where we have people from the community come and speak. We've had one of our assemblymen come, who is in charge of the chair of the judiciary, chairman of the judiciary committee. We've had people from Department of Corrections. We have somebody come from the police department coming. NAMI, the National Alliance of
Mental Illness.
Yeah. So what we're doing is raising awareness through our speaker meetings, where people can come and listen to others. So we have people affected by incarceration. The community at large is invited. Students are invited. We have people from law enforcement coming. And basically, with those two events a month, we're raising awareness and helping people, along with some other events that we're doing that we could talk about as we continue.
How did you come to be interested in this kind of work?
My brother was incarcerated a week ago, so FIP was one of the groups that I went to from time to time and never really got too involved, but I knew it was a place that I could go where I could talk to people and feel safe, and they could answer my questions, and I didn't feel so alone. So I went to those meetings on and off for about 15 years until my brother passed away. He passed away in prison. And I stayed in touch with the group but didn't really do a whole lot until I decided to really move forward and make a difference and help people.
My condolences on the loss of your brother.
Thank you.
What was it like when your brother went to prison? How did that affect you?
Oh, it changed my life. And I talk about it, too, when I speak to people, and the blogging that I've done and podcasting and the book that we'll talk about. I mean, it was like entering a different world, and especially when he went in, the internet wasn't so prevalent. So I really didn't have anybody to talk to or get information from aside from him. So it was really, really difficult time, and I lived in a shadow. I didn't talk about it. I was living the sentence with him, even though it was on the outside. So it was really horrible times until I decided to step out and talk about it. And that's why I think it's so important now for people that are in the situation to be able to talk about it, to have the ability to talk about it and to remove the stigma.
So when you decided to begin talking about it, did you just come straight to this organization, or did you kind of stumble into it? Was there a lot going on back then with support for people who had family members in prison?
Well, I was involved with the group, with FIP. However, before I got involved with FIP, as far as stepping in and reconstituting it, I decided to do a blog and a podcast. So I still was in the background, mm-hmm. right? I still was hidden, but I could talk about it. So through my website, I would write about it. I'd interview people, and I'd tell other people's stories. So slowly, that's how I started talking about it. And after a couple of years, people wanted me to come out and speak and to interview me. So about 2 years ago, I came out, and my picture's out there, my face is out there, I'm out there, and now I'm vulnerable. I'm out there. But it took a long, long time for me to talk about it. And that's why I think it's so important for people to not have to go through that, that they can talk about it now, that there's resources now, that there's people to support them.
You mentioned feeling vulnerable. Can you explain how that feels for someone who has a loved one who's in prison, where they've committed no crime, but they still feel vulnerable?
Oh, yeah. Anytime that there's a stigma or somebody's taken into the system, whether they're arrested, whether they're incarcerated, you know, whatever it is, there's still news about it, right? Sometimes it's in the newspaper, sometimes it's on TV, sometimes it's on social media. So automatically people don't see the family as not being a part of that. So you're vulnerable because no matter what happens in your family, that you're thought of as a part of it. And it's really going to take you to separate yourself from that, for you to be able to talk about it, for you to have your power and you to be strong to move forward and not feel like the victim. You can come out a hero or a victim, and a lot of people are vulnerable. A lot of people feel like a victim, and a lot of people don't speak up. And that's where I think we can make a big change.
What do families of incarcerated people need in order to survive their loved one's sentence?
The most important thing in my mind is to keep the prison family together. It doesn't matter. I've interviewed people all different ages, children who have parents that are incarcerated, mothers, grandmothers, fathers, and it doesn't matter what the person did to break the law, unless of course they've hurt somebody in the family, that's something different. But when somebody's incarcerated, the family still loves them. They don't like what they did. A lot of times they don't know if they're innocent or not. Of course, we think that our loved one is innocent. Sometimes they have admitted. So whatever the reason, you still love that person. And especially for children, that's their parent. They want to see their parent. So I think the most important thing is to keep the prison family together. And what makes that difficult is the cost. Because what people don't realize is that when somebody's incarcerated, if they're in the local jail, let's say they just get a sentence that's less than a year, that might be convenient for the family to go. But if they're put into a state prison or a federal prison, that could be hundreds or thousands of miles away. So now you're looking at not only emotional impact, but a financial impact. So I think number one is to keep the prisoner family together, and number two is figure out how can we keep the prison family together. And there's different methods and things going on nowadays that people can do to stay connected.
What are the biggest barriers that families of prisoners have to staying connected?
Well, I think financial is a big one, because people don't realize. I just read an article I don't want to quote it, remember exactly, but it was like billions of dollars that the family is spending every year to see their loved ones. So I think one of the biggest barriers is how to communicate. you know, now we have video conferencing. Is that good or bad? I don't know. But it could be something good that if you can't travel, if you can't take, you know, your whole family, I mean, if you have to fly somewhere, right? So you look at the cost to fly, say, 4 or 5 people, get a hotel, feed them. You know, maybe there are other options that are better to keep the family together so that they can see each other and have daily or weekly conversations.
What about recidivism? One of the things that people really have concerns about with families of incarcerated persons is recidivism, and also how the crime itself will impact the family, the children especially. Do you talk about that in your group?
We talk about recidivism as far as keeping, you know, how are we going to help the inmate when he or she comes home?
Right.
You know, that's number one, with recidivism. I have several families who have prepared for their loved one to come home, because sometimes when they come home, they're still on out on parole.
They're still on parole, yeah.
So, you know, there's certain things that the family has to do to keep the house ready. You know, they might not be able to, there might be curfew. So it's really important for the family to support the person that's coming home and to be ready for it, because the person coming home is not the same person that went in.
Right.
So talking about recidivism for that person is really just having the training, whether that, I know some of the Department of Corrections are putting together programs or have programs, some are good, that help people on the outside or somebody coming back into society prepare, and we need to improve those programs. That's really important. Also preparing the family for when their loved one comes home so that they can enter society in a healthy way. And then also for the children, we talk about keeping the prison family together. So the children seeing their parent actually is a good thing. I know people who haven't told their children that their father's working across the country or something, mm-hmm. and they don't see it, and they find out later, and then it really bothers them, the older kids that I've spoken to that have found out. So I think it's really important for the kids to see that. And I also think that in keeping the family together, that will help reduce recidivism. And there's also, I know, programs in schools, too, that are talking more about incarceration for the kids to keep them healthy and out of trouble.
It seems like having a healthy and supportive family is one of the most important ways that you can survive as an individual once you've gotten out. So yeah.
One of the programs, it's a restorative justice. I know that they're putting into a lot of the schools, and that's helping the kids. They're getting to the root of it, why they do it. Instead of just punishing them, they're getting to the root of it so that they can help them.
So you're working on a book right now. Your book is called Prison, the Hidden Sentence. Can you tell me about that?
Yep. What I found was that there was really no one place for me to figure out, you know, what is everything that I need to be aware of? Something that could have helped me when my brother was first incarcerated, when we didn't have all the resources on the internet. And it basically goes through my story, little parts of my story, about what happened when my brother got arrested, what I knew, what I didn't know could have helped me, what happened when we went to court, what happened when he was incarcerated and what visitation was like. And then things that people can do to keep themselves healthy while their loved one is in the prison system. So it's really just a little book, a little, I call it a primer, but it's what to do when your loved one's taken into the prison system, and it gives you steps on how to best take care of yourself.
That's great. Sometimes law enforcement will use families against people who are incarcerated, like as bargaining chips, or even as like ways of trying to get them, persuade them to take certain kinds of sentences, accept plea deals. Was that something that you faced, or that you and your organization discusses the roles that law enforcement plays with families in terms of sentencing?
Yeah, we take it on a case-by-case basis, and it's really up to the family and their attorneys, seeing how their attorneys are providing information to them, if it's the right attorney for them. So we support the families. We don't tell them what to do. They really need to make the decision and decide whether it is a plea is the way to go for the case. So we'll provide information, but we can't tell them what to do. It's really up to somebody their attorney or somebody with a legal background to guide them in that way. We can only give opinions.
Legal costs are obviously huge. They must be a big part of what people who are love their incarcerated person enough to care for them have end up having to pay for. So does that, is that something that you also discuss in your group, is legal costs and you know, supporting people through that process of maybe having to mortgage your house, you know, all sorts of things, cash out your IRA to help pay for a lawyer?
Yeah, we haven't gotten to a situation where we've had to give financial advice to somebody. It's really whether they can afford an attorney or not. We don't want to see anybody lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it, again, it's really up to the person as to what they want to do.
Yeah,
I've seen especially mothers go into a lot of debt for their child, and maybe that was or was not the best decision. So again, it's not our place to tell somebody to go into debt. We do advise getting the best legal counsel that they can, to shop around, and if they need to get a public defender, to just make sure that they're involved.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the issues that face people with loved ones who are, like you were telling me that in your book, you talk about the steps that you had to go through in order to educate yourself. What are some of those steps that people need to know in order to educate themselves about a loved one who's going through this whole process?
Well, essentially it starts with the arrest, and of course getting an attorney or the best legal representation that you can. And then also what it's like when you go to see your loved one in jail, and to make sure that you can put money on their account, depending if they're going to be in jail for a few days or a week. You just don't know how long they're going to be in there. And to make sure that you wear the right clothes, to know if you need to make an appointment. I mean, who knew that in order to visit somebody that's been arrested that you need to make an appointment in some jurisdictions?
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that you fill out all the paperwork and do everything you can, from if they're in jail, if they are incarcerated, if you go to court and they're incarcerated, and just some of the things like when they do go to court, and if they are set free, right? It doesn't mean that they're going to come home right away. They still have to be processed. It's all these like little things that people aren't aware of. You know, what is it like when you go to a prison? I mean, it's not a very pleasant experience, and a lot of times you're not treated well. So you just need to be prepared for it, that it's not you. It's everybody out there has a bad day. So you're going to experience that when you're dealing with different people in the prison system. So you need to know what you can wear, what you can bring, when visiting hours are, how to fill out the paperwork, and just to be prepared of the environment. And those are just things that if you haven't been through it, a lot of people don't know about. And then also when your loved one comes home, you know, that, like I said earlier, and I emphasize, it's not the same person. It doesn't matter how long they've been in the system. It's not the same person. And there's going to be changes, and you just need to be prepared for that so that you can help them and also help yourself. And things that families can do, just taking care of yourself, going to talk to somebody, finding a safe group. There's just so many things that people need to do, and setting boundaries. It's just really preparing people for the whole process.
What are some of those changes? You've mentioned that a couple of times, and being someone who works with a lot of family members and also maybe has seen people who have gone through the system, can you generally say what are some of the changes that people go through when they've been through the incarceration system, like that they come out different?
Well, somebody that's been incarcerated, don't forget, they've been told what to do. They've been told when to get up, when to eat, when to sit down. They need to stand up for count. They're not allowed outside. They might not see the sun for a while. So when they come out, you just can't expose them to a lot of noise. Like, you can't just take them to the mall. In most cases, I can't talk for everybody. So you want to make sure that you bring them back into society slowly, not giving them too many choices. I mean, if they've been in there 3 months, 3 years, or 30 years, they haven't decided what they're going to eat, what they're going to wear. It's all given to them. So you need to slowly give them decisions to make so that they can start making decisions for themselves. Some inmates come out with PTSD, and that's a whole nother thing that people don't think about. It's not just people going to war. So it's bringing them back into society slowly, lovingly, and at the rate of the person that can take it, you know, that will work for them. And the other thing is that if they were the breadwinner, they were the breadwinner of the house, and they come home and they expect to be the person in charge, well, the spouse that's been there for, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, is now in charge and has been making the decisions. So there could be a little struggle there where they really need to define who does what and really work on their communication, take things slowly, and make sure that the person coming back into society is taken in slowly so that they can adapt and then go into working and be a productive person in society.
With regard to family members coming back, you touched on something that really interests me, which is the role that what happens when people have PTSD, when they've been in prison and they've been traumatized. Do you talk about that in your groups? Do you have any experience with that?
You know, that's something that's new to me. I have a friend, a new friend, who was incarcerated. He was in the service, and he came out maybe, I think, 3 years ago. And he's the one that's told me about PTSD. So it's something I'm really just learning about, but it makes total sense to me that, you know, they're going through a trauma when they're incarcerated. And yes, most people say, yes, they are serving their sentence and they deserve whatever, but they are human beings. So when they come out, and if we want them to be contributing to society, we're going to have to deal with their PTSD too. So that's something new to me that I'm learning more about.
I'm going to ask you a really general question, and you can answer it from whatever perspective you feel like you need to. I'm wondering, do you think that our prison system is just? Do you think that the way that we do incarceration in the United States is fair?
You know, we have a saying, conversations instead of shame, and programs instead of prison. So I think that there's a lot of programs that could be put out there for people that are incarcerated, especially when it comes to drugs, people that are addicted to drugs. I know one member in particular whose son is in and out of prison. Good person, but he's addicted to drugs. So could there be another program for him? I believe so. I believe that a lot of what we're seeing with sex offenders, that's a horrible, heinous crime. But if we're seeing it a lot, is there something that we need to be doing as a society to provide programs for those type of people? There are heinous crimes. There are things that people do, and we do need our criminal justice system. But I do believe that we can put out more programs that would save more money and help more people and have more productive citizens if we could provide these programs in the prisons instead of building more prisons, build programs, buildings with programs for people.
Do you think that sentences are too long? One of the things that I notice the most when I talk to people inside is that it may have been like 6 or 7 years, and after 6 or 7 years, they've cleaned up, they've sobered up, mm-hmm. they've done all of the work that they needed to do inside I'm not sure what other word to use, to atone for the crime that they've committed. They've done all of their own personal work. They've tried to reach out. They've done all their training. And then they're in for another 20 years. Do you see that much in your community?
That's where I think the programs can come in. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody's incarcerated for 30 years, it's a life lost. And do they deserve to be in there? I think that each case is different.
Yeah.
However, I think it depends on the crime. And there's a lot of people that are incarcerated for things that don't deserve a lifetime sentence, that people can be rehabilitated. And I think the fear on the side of the criminal justice system is that if they let somebody out and they reoffend, then it's their fault. But if they can create programs and somebody serve their time, go through a program, and there's programs out there that have proven to help people. I mean, we have a local program called Hope for Prisoners that provides education and training for inmates coming out, and it's been very successful. So if we take our incarceration in our prisons, move it over to a program, some kind of managed program that somebody goes through, and then put them into society, I think that would make a difference. That would be rehabilitative.
We've been talking today with Julia Lazarek with Friends and Family of Incarcerated Persons. Julia, you've also got a podcast. Where can people find your podcast?
Yeah, the podcast is Prison, The Hidden Sentence, and we're on social media at Hidden Sentence and Facebook and Twitter.
And you've done a lot of interviews, so you must have some sense of what's going on out there.
It's just really amazing when you hear people talk and you hear what their story is. For me, it's just opened my eyes that I really don't know anybody. When I first started talking about it, I have a friend I've known for 15 years, and I found out her daughter was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we need to be able to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think through interviews and for people opening up, that someday it'll be open, that somebody could say their husband or child is incarcerated and people won't look at them funny, or that kids will not be bullied or made fun of, and other parents will let their kids play with the kids because the kids are innocent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that available on iTunes, Stitcher?
It's on iTunes. Mm-hmm.
Great. And then you've got a book coming out with the same name, Prison, The Hidden Sentence?
Correct. Yeah, that'll be out early next year. I'll let you know.
Okay, great. Well, we really look forward to that. And your organization is Friends and Family of Incarcerated Persons. If people want to find out more about that organization, where can they find out about it?
They can go online to the FIP, that's theffip.org. That's a nonprofit. It's called the FIP.
Do you have like a Facebook presence, any social media presence?
It's all under Hidden Sentence.
It's all under Hidden Sentence. Great.
Because we do believe that when somebody's incarcerated, that it's a hidden sentence for the family, and we're trying to break that.
Thanks. Well, it sounds like you're doing some really great work, Julia. Thank you so much for joining us tonight on Prison Pipeline.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
That was Prison Pipeline. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Up next is Hard Knock Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is working with Beautiful Portland to collect socks and blankets for those who are sleeping outside this winter. There is a collection box in the lobby of KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, between Burnside and Ankeny. Donations are accepted Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and or lease non-renewal notices. The phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
Rip. Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., you're tuned in to Hard Rock Radio.
No, Hard Knock. Just say this hard is knock. Yeah, Hard Knock. Hard yeah, knock. So you just got to say this is Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
This is Reverend
and Jeremiah Wright, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yo. This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You're tuned in to Hard Knock. Yo, keep it real, right? You know what I'm saying?
Wait, one more time, because they are not gonna believe it was you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr., and you're tuned in to Hard Knock. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. God bless you.
Profiles in Black. America's Negro pioneers, past and present.
Afternoon, that the brotherhood of man will become a reality in this day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing with the Negroes in the spiritual of all, free at last, free at last. Thank God about it.
More than 250,000 persons, 60,000 of them white, were gathered before the Lincoln Monument that day in August 1963 when Dr. Martin Luther King made his dramatic speech, I Have a Dream. A third-generation Baptist minister, King inherited a tradition of protest from his grandfather and his father, both leading Atlanta pastors. After graduating from Morehouse College and getting his Doctor of Philosophy degree from Boston University, Dr. King began preaching at Dexter Avenue Church in Montgomery, Alabama. His leadership of the Montgomery bus boycott changed isolated protest against racial injustice into organized mass movements that swept the country. Winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for his dramatic use of nonviolence until his assassination.